We come this morning to the 29th chapter of the book of Job. I say that with a certain amount of surprise, given that it's been only 19 sermons to get to this point. But nonetheless, here we are as we come now to the last bit of round three of the speeches between Job and his friends that are found starting in chapter 4 and making it to this particular point. You remember that in this last round, Eliphaz spoke again to open this round in chapters 22 through 24, and Job responded to that in those chapters. And then Bildad begins to speak, and Job just cuts him off, says, "Stop talking," when he realized that his friends could not or would not offer any sound theological and relevant advice. And Job wanted instead to focus on a higher view of God than they hold. So this morning, as we come to chapter 29, then we're coming to the last bit of this third round. But in a sense, we're coming to something else. We're coming to Job's final speech of this book. This is the last speech that Job will give in this entire book. Now, have you note two things. First, you'll notice that in chapter 29, there is a verse 1 in which it said, "And Job again took up his discourse." All right, you've seen that before. I haven't really focused on it before, but it's been along the way, and it seems to denote different places or phases of these speeches along the way. And so I see chapter 9 breaking from chapter 28 and before by virtue of that statement. And you will notice also that chapter 31 ends with the words of Job are ended. So this is here the last speech of Job in the book. Now, I realize that Job will speak again briefly. He will speak to God in chapter 40, verses 3 through 5, and 42, 1 to 6. But those are not going to be speeches. They're only going to be words of repentance for what he has been saying up to this point. All right, so they're not going to be speeches in the sense of what we see here, but simply just responses to God. Now, as has been my habit, it seems appropriate each week to draw something out of this particular section that we're working on from the words of John Calvin. You remember he preached 159 times through this book, and in sermon 118 from this series, specifically on chapter 31, 35 to 40, he points out the following, and I'll put this as our consideration this morning. It is a dangerous thing to confront God for answers to life's issues. It is a dangerous thing to go before the living God, especially when we think that we are in the right or deserve an answer. It is a dangerous thing to do this. Now, true, sometimes the circumstances and the sufferings of our life are according to the threats that God makes in his law. I mean, probably the best example is Genesis 2:17. If you eat from this tree, you will die. All right, that's very clear that what happened to Adam was as a result of a direct statement by God in which he said, "This is going to happen if you do this." Okay. So sometimes our sufferings are according to the threats that God makes in his law. But remember, in this book, we know that God is not punishing Job for his sins. Now, he deserves to be. We all do. But we know that this is not the point. The point of these sufferings is clearly apparent from chapters 1 and 2, remember. The sufferings of Job are a means by which God will show the faith and the patience of his servant. He's showing them to the audience that's watching, and he's showing his purposes in and through this. Under his divinely ordained purpose, Job is suffering in order to display something. All right, so this is not Job being beaten down, as his friends assert, for something he's done. This is something greater than that. So while it is true that sometimes we get what we deserve because breaking the law, there's a lot of times that that's not the case. And so You will notice, however, up to this point, Job has been attempting to do two things. He has pled with God through the course of his speeches to do two things. Number one, to make a case for his own integrity. And number two, to know why, or to get an answer as to why he is enduring the way he is. It's the essence of Job's replies to his friends. His friends are saying, "You're suffering because you did this or that." And Job is saying, "No, I'm a man of integrity." And part of his speech has been to plead with God, asking for an answer in the midst of all this. But now, as we've seen over these last ending speeches, Job is coming to realize that any attempt to make a case before the Almighty is fraught with danger. For the sinful man must recognize, and here I'll quote Calvin, quote, "There is nothing more frightening than for God to enter into a legal encounter with us. If he makes himself the plaintiff, alas, what can happen to us? So if we continue to provoke him and seek to plead against him, do we not do so to our great bewilderment? And how will that turn out? If he wishes to use his power and keep us ignorant, as it were, wanting us not to know why he is using such great rigor against us, even in such an extreme time, we must still lower our heads and find our refuge in what we have already declared, namely, that God is always and everywhere just. And yet, even though we do not know the reason he torments us, let us continue to glorify him at all times." End quote. You see, what Calvin says is that Job's final speech, the one we're going to look at here in 29, 30, and 31, is a recognition. Job is coming to realize something. He's coming to recognize something. And the recognition is this: there is no point in attempting to defend oneself before God. There may be no answer forthcoming. And it is okay to be okay with that. Sometimes there's not an answer. But attempting to force God to give one, or attempting to defend oneself before God in order to establish something, is fraught with danger. For what can a man say to God that would change his mind? Or as Paul says in Romans 11, who has been his counsel? So Job's final speech is a recognition. The faith of Job is beginning to genuinely show up. We're starting to see it in genuine sense. His friends attempted to derail it, but now Job realizes that the only proper answer is to simply settle in by faith to whatever God has purposed for him. He's beginning to realize this. And so he now will, in these three chapters, do three things. Number one, he will reflect upon his life as it was in the past. Number two, he will look at his present situation. And then number three, he will look forward to what he hopes is revealed and vindicated in the future. Past, present, future. Easy outline for this speech. Chapter 29, then Job reflects upon his past. And he says in verse 2 of that chapter, "Oh, that I were as in the months of old, as in the days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone upon my head, and by his light I walked through darkness, as I was in my prime, when the friendship of God was upon my tent, when the Almighty was yet with me, when my children were all around me, when my steps were washed with butter, and the rock poured out for me streams of oil." He remembers a time when life was good. He remembers a time before all of this suffering that he's experiencing. He remembers a time when God was with him. And he looks back with great fondness upon those days, even as I read. But in verses 7 to 25, then, following what I read here, he lists a number of things that were special to him in those days. So the rest of the chapter is basically a list of all of the things that he looks back upon with a certain fondness. And I'll just list them quickly for you. He says, the young men saw me and withdrew. The aged rose and stood, verse 8. He was a man of respect. Princes and nobles were hushed as he came out, verses 9 and 10. He says, at the city gate, they would rise when I would come to the city gate. They would stand and they would see me coming and they would give me honor. The city gate, you remember, is where the honored men would gather to discuss the business of the city and to make judgments over legal matters. That's what Lot was doing at the city gate in Genesis chapter 19. And the people of the town didn't particularly care for Lot making such judgments over them. And by the way, just so you know, the New Testament term ekklesia, which we get our word church from, is a Greek word that literally means called out, those who are called out. It's applied to a gathering of a city council that would come together to render judgments. So the term was a well-known term and a well-known place within a city and a well-known group of men in a city. But the early church, the early followers of Christ, took this word and applied it to themselves with its meaning of being called out, as meaning as those who are called out as honored, and as a gathering of those who have been gathered together in Christ. So the word has those connotations of being called out and then gathered together. And so they took this word and they used it to apply to the church. And I think the Spirit of God led them to do this because the element of a people who are called out because they are honored is applicable. So Job is looking back to a day when he had such honor in the city. Secondly, he says, because I delivered the poor, the blessings of him who was about to perish came upon me. I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy, verses 12 and 13. He was a man with a reputation for being generous to others, including the poor and those in dire straits. So he looks back upon a day when he could be generous because he had such a reputation. Thirdly, he says, I put on righteousness and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe, verse 14. He was a man of justice. He was, as he said, eyes to the blind, verse 15, father to the needy, verse 16. He took from his own understanding of righteousness and applied it fairly to others. The negative of that is found in the next verse, verse 17. I broke the fangs of the unrighteous. He overcame the power of the unjust. He looks back to a day when he would go to the city gate and judge, but he would do so justly and righteously. So he looks back upon the honor he had. He looks back upon the reputation that he had. He looks back upon what his righteousness allowed him to do. Fourthly, men listened to me and waited. Verse 21, I smiled on them when they had no confidence. Verse 24, I chose their way and sat as chief. Verse 25, he was a man of wisdom. Others looked up to him for advice and direction in their lives. Like one who comforts mourners, he says, those who don't know where to find comfort and help. So Job lists all of these things that he looks back on with a certain pride, a positive sense of the word, in which he says, this is what I was. He reflects on a fulfilling life, having respect, a reputation for generosity, being just, and having wisdom. He looks back upon all of that and he looks at that and says, oh, those were the days. But it's important to see that he attributes it all as, verse 2, days when God watched over me. Okay? As I gave you that list, your natural inclination was to think, man, the guy's bragging about himself. But he's not, because what he is saying as he starts the speech is those were the days when the Lord watched over me. In verses 2 through 6, as I read, he reiteratively speaks of God watching over him. God's light was with him, verse 3. He had God's friendship in verse 4. His life was filled with God's prosperity in verses 5 and 6. In other words, Job recognizes that all of the blessings of his life are due to the presence and blessing of the Lord. He was what he was, and he did what he did only because of God's blessing. That's his point. In chapter 29, he's saying, my life was good. I had a reputation for generosity and justice and wisdom and righteousness. But the only reason is because God was watching over me. He was what he was and did what he did because of God's blessing. See, here's what we know. See, we can step back from this book for a moment. We can step back from chapter 29 and we can say we know that Job was a man of righteousness as a function of God's decree. You see, we can step back and say the reason that he was what he was is because of God's pronouncement over him. Have you considered my servant Job? As I've said many times, that was not an observation. That was a proclamation. That was God saying, this is true. Job is a man who is righteous. Not because I just happened to find him, but because I declared him to be so, because I made him to be so, because he lived his life under my blessings and under my direction. Job was righteous because God declared it to be so in order for God to accomplish a greater purpose. You see. You might say, you could stop right here and say, yep, you see the contrast, don't you? A life in which God had purposed him to be upright and prosperous and wise, and now a life where he's sitting on a hill scraping himself with a piece of pottery and having to deal with some moronic friends. But both are under the ordination of God. Both of them are purposed by God. Both of them are what he, the Lord, has purposed over Job. And Job is recognizing that. He's recognizing that, you see? He's beginning to see this. Job reflects upon his life and recognizes a life of righteousness. It's a righteousness that poured out of him only by the grace of God over him. He's not making any claims here to being righteous of his own. He's claiming to be righteous because God had blessed him with this. In other words, Job has no more reason to defend himself before God. He's not going to do that again. He recognizes that his former life of righteousness and prosperity is from the hand of the Almighty. And so he pauses here. In a sense, you might say, here's the last thing I'm going to say to you, Eliphaz and Zophar and Bildad, and everyone else who wants to listen. I am what I am because God has made me so. Which leads him then to chapter 30. Job now reflects on what has changed. That was the life he had before, but now he begins to reflect on his current situation. Chapter 30, verse 1. But now they laugh at me, men who are younger than I, whose fathers I would have disdained to set with the dogs of my flock. What could I gain from the strength of their hands, men whose vigor is gone? Through want and hard hunger they gnaw the dry ground by night in waste and desolation. They pick saltwort and the leaves of bushes and the roots of the broom tree for their food. Skip down to verse 9. And now I have become their song. I am a byword to them. They abhor me. They keep aloof from me. They do not hesitate to spit at the sight of me, because God has loosed my cord and humbled me. They have cast off restraint in my presence. Here's what Job does. He laments that those from whom he once had respect now mock him. He used to be a man who could go down to the city gate and judge with wisdom and righteousness, and men found their wisdom in him. They could go to him and get advice, but now they mock him. Specifically, you will notice he says in verse 1, men who are younger than I. In other words, those who should respect me, even if it's not earned. Because that was how it was in an ancient agrarian society. Older men were respected by younger men automatically because that is the way it was. That's the way it was. But now Job says, yeah, men who are younger than me, men whose fathers I wouldn't even allow to live amongst my dogs, those kind of men disrespect me. So in verses 3 through 8, which I read part of, he describes those who now disrespect him. In contrast to before, when they respected him, now they disrespect him. They gnaw the dry ground, verse 3. They pick saltwort, which is a sour-tasting plant that poor people would eat. The roots of the broom tree for fruit, in verse 4. They are driven out from human company, verse 5. In the gullies they dwell, verse 6. They have been whipped out of the land. Specifically, all of that is they have no food, they have no companionship, they live in terrible conditions. Now, how many of you have noticed the irony here? What's he saying? He's saying those who laugh, verse 1, those who laugh at me thinking I'm the needy one are in fact needy themselves. They're the desperate ones. They're the ones that are desperate because they're the ones living in gullies and eating saltwort and broom tree roots and so on. They've got nothing. You see, as a result of the disasters that have come upon him, again, under God's purposes, notice what he says in verse 11, because God has loosed my cord and humbled me, right? As a result of the disasters that have come upon him, those who once respected and honored him have turned away. His sufferings have become a means by which others now mock him. Interesting, isn't it? Here he was a man of great respect, wisdom, and righteousness. And just because he's had a few tragedies in his life, everybody now mocks him, treats him with disrespect. But Job sees them as the ones to be pitied. Job sees them as the ones to be pitied. Now, don't miss that. You have a man sitting here who's lost everything except his wife. And we're not so sure about her. He's lost everything. And yet he's sitting there scraping himself with a piece of pottery, dealing with these moronic friends, and he's the one saying, you know what? They need to be pitied, not me. They're the ones who need to be pitied. So in verses 9 to 15 of this chapter, chapter 30, Job describes their now pitiable reaction to him. He says in verse 10, they abhor me. Verse 9, I'm a byword to them. They don't hesitate to spit at the sight of me. Verse 10, they've cast off restraint in my presence. Verse 11, meaning they say whatever comes to their minds. They break up my path, verse 13, meaning they actually put stumbling blocks in my path. And terrors are turned upon me. They bring upon me all kinds of disaster. Now I'll pause here and point out something. This is the reaction of fallen people when God lifts his hand of restraint from them. This is what reprobate men do when God lifts his hand of restraint. In other words, this is what happens when men are freed by God to do whatever they want to do. The hard cry of man is, I want to do what I want to do. The hard cry of man is, I want to be God. I want to set the standards. I want to set the rules. I want to set the parameters. I want to do what I want to do. That's the hard cry of a fallen race. And that is what you get when God says, go ahead. Go ahead. You see, what God has done in the midst of all this, and Job is now realizing it, is that God has put suffering and difficulty into his life. True. But at the same time, God has also lifted his hand of restraint from others, and their true colors are now shining through. Their true colors are now shining true. And this is common amongst sinful men for the reprobate to mock and cheer when trouble befalls those pursuing the things of God. The reprobate, you see it as an opportunity to mock God when those of us who choose to follow after Christ suffer, have trouble and difficulties. You see it? It's the common response of the reprobate man. It's what he does. He's waiting, just like a spring-loaded thing, to pounce upon the first little trouble that we Christians have. Oh, you worship a God who's sovereign, and yet this is what you're experiencing? What are you bothering with that for? What a waste of time. Why are you worshiping a God who leaves you in such misery? Nah, it's proof that your God is foolish and you're foolish to follow him. You see it? This is what you have when God lifts his hand of restraint. This is what you have when God says, okay, fine. You want to be what you want to be? All right, go ahead. And this is why you see such derision against Christians, no matter where they are, no matter when they are, because the reprobate are always looking for an opportunity. There's no greater example of it than when Jesus is hanging on the cross. In Luke chapter 23, 35 to 38, what are they doing? What are the people standing around doing? Mocking him, jeering at him, tempting him, if you will. Hey, if you are truly the Son of God, come on down from that cross. You can't, can you? I see you're not anything you think you are. See it? It's what reprobate men do, you see. So, again, the irony is, although it appears that Job is the needy one, it becomes all too apparent to him that they are the truly needy. Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, along with anybody else who has looked upon Job's situation with glee, they're the truly needy ones. And Job's come to realize that. Oh, sure, I might be suffering. But what's a little pimple compared to spiritual death that they experience every day? The horribleness of the life and the world that they live in. You see it? Again, Job has no reason to defend himself before God. He recognizes that his former friends now mock him because that's what sinful, spiritually needy men do. That's what they do. So he's realizing it. Notice he's recognizing these things. He's begun to see them now as we see them more fully. Which leads us to chapter 30, verses 16 and beyond, okay? And this, Job is our friend, all right? So let's keep that in mind. Here's what he says in verse 16 of that chapter. And now my soul is poured out within me. Days of affliction have taken hold of me. The night racks my bones, and the pain that gnaws me takes no rest. With great force my garment is disfigured. It binds me about like the collar of my tunic. Try imagining wearing some sort of robe over a skin disease. That's what you get, right? If you've ever had shingles, you know what this is like, okay? God has cast me into the mire, and I become like dust and ashes. Skip down to 24. Yet does not one in a heap of ruins stretch out his hand in his disaster, cry for help? Did I not weep for him whose day was hard? Was not my soul grieved for the needy? Okay, that's a flashback to before. But when I hoped for good, evil came. When I waited for light, darkness came. My inward parts are in turmoil and never still. Days of affliction come to meet me. And so on. Now, here's what he's doing. Job is our friend. And he's a lot like us. Okay, he's a lot like me. Job still laments his own struggle. He still laments his own reality. Okay, all of what I just read and talked about the first half of chapter 30 sounds like, wow, Job has really turned the corner, baby, hasn't he? Yeah. And then he slips right back into being what he is, a man, like any of us, because he starts lamenting his own struggle, his own internal struggle. Now, again, Job is certainly growing in his faith and understanding, but he has not yet reached full maturity, right? He is living what I call the common reality of the saved. The common reality of the saved, which is the struggle with the flesh that leads to doubt and confusion. Right, we've been talking about this on Wednesday night in the doctrine of sanctification. We talk about it as a war. There's a war. The confession writers use that word. It's a war. It's a war between what we know to be true in our minds and in our hearts by virtue of having been born again by the Spirit of God, and the flesh, the outward flesh, which is constantly, hello. I use my M&M's obsession as an example of this. The flesh is always with me. And then there are others, God bless their soul, who bring me bags of M&M's and feed my wickedness, okay? But you see it. It's the flesh. It's the outward flesh. And Job is living this common reality of the saved, especially when everybody else is piling on, okay? Especially when everybody else is going, yeah, it's your fault. Yep, it's your fault, right? So he's described this inner turmoil. I read a part of it, but all of 16 to 31 is this internal turmoil. And he's made a number of things about the night racks my bones. He's cast me into the mire. I cry to you for help. You don't answer me. My inner parts are turmoil. I go about darkened. My lyre is turned to mourning. A lyre is one of those instruments that's actually very upbeat, but apparently you can play it in such a way that it sounds like a funeral dirge. Okay, you get the point. Here's what's happening. Like all justified men, Job struggles with sanctification. He struggles with the natural tendency of the flesh to raise doubts and fears in our spirit about the goodness of God. Okay? So chapter 30 is a great dichotomy between a man on the one hand who understands in his mind what is true, and then in his flesh is continuing to wrestle with these realities. In other words, he's me and all of you. Because this is the human condition. Even though we have been justified, even though we've come before God, put our faith in Christ, nonetheless, we still struggle with doubt. We still wrestle with the flesh and the temptations of the flesh. We find ourselves yelling at our spouse for no reason and wonder. And it's the flesh again. Job has no reason to defend himself before God. Now, he recognizes that his current life of rejection and misery is from the hand of God. He realizes that. He still struggles with the reality of that. But the good news is that Job does turn the corner from that. All right, so he's not embedded in that when you get to chapter 31 and you see where he goes with it. So here's chapter 31, down to verse 5. If I have walked with falsehood and my foot has hastened to deceit, let me be weighed in a just balance and let God know my integrity. If my step has turned aside from the way and my heart has gone after my eyes, and if any spot has stuck to my hands, then let me sow and another eat, and let what grows for me be rooted out. Let's skip all the way down to verse 35. Oh, that I had one to hear me. Here is my signature. Let the Almighty answer me. Oh, that I had the indictment written by my adversary. Surely I would carry it on my shoulder. I would bind it on me as a crown. I would give him an account of all my steps like a prince. I would approach him. So here's what he's doing again. He gets out of the pity party of the second half of verse of chapter 30. All right? Because the natural tendency of the flesh is to lead us again into thinking we'll never have success. But he stops and goes, wait a minute. Wait a minute. I know something. I know better than that. And he contends again that he has been righteous. Now, chapter 31, the entire section, is characterized by a series of conditional clauses, if statements. They're starting in sections beginning in verse 5, 9, 13, 16, 24, 29, and 38. There's seven of them in this section. And there's a series of subordinate conditionals within each section. Each starting if proposes a hypothetical. A hypothetical. If. Okay? If I am guilty of this or that, then I am worthy to be judged by God in a certain way appropriate to the sin of which I am guilty. All right, so that's what he's going to be doing. If. All right, if I have spoken falsehood, then my crop should fail, verses 5 and 8. If I lust towards a woman, then my wife should go away, verse 9 and 10. If I have unfair support of my servants, then I should receive a similar fate from God in 13 and 14, and so on. All the way through the chapter, you see this again and again and again. However, the point of each of these ifs is rhetorical. He's saying, I am not guilty of any of these things. That's what he's saying. My life has demonstrated this by the fact that none of these judgments have befallen me. Okay? If I've looked lustfully after a woman, my wife should go away and leave me. But she hasn't. Now, she made some rather foolish statements, but she's still there. And she's still going to bring him blessing in that she's going to give him more children when this story's all over, right? So that's what Job is saying. The judgment that should come if I was guilty has not come. Yes, I know. I'm sitting here on a hill scraping myself with a piece of pottery. But these kinds of judgments that he lists have not taken place over me. And all the, if you go through chapter 1 and look at all the judgments that he lists in all these seven sections, none of them have actually happened to him. None of them have happened to them. So he's making the point that I have not been unrighteous. Before this attack by the devil, Job had lived without any of these judgments in his life. And so here's what he's doing. He's paralleling his life from chapter 29. He's saying, remember all that stuff I said at the beginning of this speech about how I was wise and righteous and acted justly? Those things are still true. Because here's what I know. If I had not been doing those things, then these judgments would have befallen me. But they have not. And so therefore, I'm contending again that I am righteous. I have lived faithfully. He could say that he's looking at his three friends and going, your judgment is wrong. Your assertion is wrong. Because if I was indeed guilty, as you say that I am, then all of these things would have happened to me. But they've not. So this, that is intertwined in the chapter, or the, I should say the foundation of the chapter, but there's something intertwined in the chapter. So let me read a few verses sprinkled throughout the chapter. Verse 1, I have made a covenant with my eyes. How then could I gaze at a virgin? What would be my portion from God above and my heritage from the Almighty on high? Verse 6, let me be weighed in a just balance and let God know my integrity. Verse 14, what then shall I do when God rises up? When he makes inquiry, what shall I answer him? Verse 23, for I was in terror of calamity from God and could not have faced his majesty. Verse 28, this also would be an iniquity to be punished by the judges, for I would have been false to God above. Verse 35, oh, that I had one to hear me. Here's my signature. Let the Almighty answer me. Oh, that I had the indictment written by my adversary. Here's what he's doing. Again, as he's done before, he's pleading for God to vindicate him. He is saying to the Almighty, if I have done these things, if I had done these things, then God himself would have brought these judgments upon me. Then he would have brought these things upon me. Sprinkled amongst his rhetorical assertions of righteousness is his belief that all of this is, and get this, known by God, understood by God. And thus he has no need to defend himself before God. So none of this plea for vindication is for him to stand before God and say, give me an answer and do it now. It's not what that is. This is him willing to back away, in essence, and say, I know what the score really is because I've seen it in my own life. As I said at the outset of the sermon, remember, to enter into a dispute with God over righteousness or unrighteousness is a foolish effort. Why? because the omniscient God knows and purposes the destinies of men. I'd say it this way. Go make a case before God. I dare you. The problem is, he knows every single sin you've ever committed. He knows every bit of unrighteousness that exists in you. He knows everything you've ever said, done, or thought about someone else that is wicked and evil. He knows. He knows everything. And so to go and stand before God and say, okay, I want to plead my case as righteous. Here's my religious activity. Here's my church attendance. Let's talk. That's not a pretty picture. And Job knows it. He knows, he recognizes that his attempts, any attempts, like his friends, to defend himself is foolish. Foolish. Doesn't make any sense. Why would I do that? It's not going to lead me anywhere but to destruction. Job is simply seeking to be vindicated in the purposes of God. In the purposes of God. That God himself knows all of this to be true because he has purposed all things in Job's life. See it? Job is beginning to figure it out. Listening to his moronic friends, Job is beginning to figure out, no. It's about God's purposes and plans, which are far greater than me or your silly, simplistic advice. You see it? Sure, Job still struggles with the flesh. He still struggles with the temptations of the flesh. That's why he's going to speak as he does when God opens his mouth. We'll see that a couple of times as we get to the end of this book. But he's beginning to realize these things. Now, so how does any man defend himself before a holy God? What do we know that Job doesn't know? Well, here's what we know. We know that in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed. Romans chapter 1, 16 and 17, the two verses that Martin Luther read to understand, finally, to understand what it meant to stand right before God. For he had spent his whole life chasing after his own personal righteousness, trying to be everything that the church told him to be, and found himself, like Job, quite often feeling less and less and less righteous and more wicked. And he reads these two verses and he discovers that in the gospel, in the message of Christ, the righteousness of God is revealed. And he realizes that any righteousness necessary to stand before God in judgment can only come from him. We possess no natural righteousness of our own. In fact, the second half of chapter 30 makes it pretty clear that even if we try to be righteous, we find ourselves being unrighteous even in the midst of our righteousness. The only man who stands righteous before God is the man. The only man who stands before God and attempts to defend himself is the fool. It's a fool's errand. And in fact, it's a dangerous thing, Calvin says, because to stand in the presence of a holy God as an unholy creature is to be destroyed. There's no other possibility. For he who is holy cannot stand that which is unholy. And so what do we need? We need an alien righteousness. A righteousness that's not our own. A righteousness that comes to us from God. A righteousness that's given to us through the work of Christ. As Paul himself says in Romans chapter 5, 18 and 19, as one trespass led to condemnation for all men. And who did that? Adam did that. As one trespass led to condemnation for all men, so one act of righteousness leads to justification and life for all men. And who did that? Christ Jesus did that. For as by the one man's disobedience the many were made sinners, so by the one man's obedience the many will be made righteous. The great transaction is in Christ. You see, what Job doesn't know, we know fully, and this is it. We don't have to defend ourselves before God. And so my advice to you is stop trying to do so. You will never defend yourself before a holy God. All you can do is stand before him with an empty hand of faith and say, I have nothing but what you give me in Christ. And I put myself completely and utterly in your hands. That's the essence of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Faith alone is the only means by which any man stands right before a holy God. Job was only beginning to understand this idea, but we have it fully fleshed out for us in the fullness of Scriptures. The Lord Jesus Christ has come, and he has given his life for us. He has lived perfectly under the law in order to create a righteousness that could be given to us by the Father. And then he has gone to the cross to take our unrighteousness upon himself. He was imputed with our evil, and we are imputed with his righteousness. And we stand before God with nothing. We speak nothing. We say nothing. We defend ourselves in no way before this God. We simply stand and say, look, I know who I really am, and you know who I really am. But your word says that if I will confess Jesus Christ as the Lord and believe that you raised him from the dead, I will be righteous in your sight. We celebrate Reformation Sunday as a reminder of this great fact. The church in the middle of the 16th and 17th centuries had lost this message. And men were running around like chickens with their heads cut off, trying to find righteousness, including Luther. But there is a righteousness, and it's a righteousness from God that has been given to us. So let us not attempt to defend ourselves before God. Let us not stand and count our tithing record and our church attendance and our baptisms and our church memberships and our service and ministry and all these other things. Let us not look to them and say, see, God must think I'm special. That's fraught with danger. Here's what we do. We stand before him and we appeal to Christ, our advocate and our intercessor.